You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with the dynamic duo of The Perennial Plate, Daniel Klein and Mira Fine.
How's it going?
Wow, that rhymes really well.
Was
that intentional?
It was. I was specifically looking for a girl to date
whose
last name reminded me.
If you don't know The Perennial Plate, it is a weekly video series of good food around the country. I mean, that's the most conflated description I can give. It's a lot more than that. But we'll kind of start a background first and then move into what you guys are priorly doing, touring around the nation.
Yeah.
Daniel actually used to work here in Brooklyn, Applewood Restaurant.
Applewood, indeed.
But prior to that, Minnesota, born and raised.
Not born and raised, just born.
Just born.
Yeah.
Never raised, just wild.
Exactly. In the boundary waters, raised by wolves.
Yeah.
No, I grew up abroad, but I was I lived in Minnesota till I was four, and then I left, and then so when I was trying to figure out where to go after New York, I went back to my roots.
Yeah. And abroad, why and where?
My parents, they found a job in England, so I grew up in England.
Excellent. And then we'll fast forward. Childhood be damned. cooking though. Here in Brooklyn, Applewood, was that after you went to school or
So my mom has a bed and breakfast in England. She's an amazing cook and she teaches cooking classes.
You can plug her. What's her name? Where is that?
Her name's Shayla. And Burvale House is the name of it. I don't know. Yeah. Anyways, it's if you're ever in England, in Surrey, it's a lovely place to stay. But anyway, so she instilled in me, cooking knowledge and the sort of cook with what you have mentality. And so I went to college, went to NYU, which is why I ended up in New York. I didn't study film, didn't study cooking.
What did you study?
I was in Gallatin, which is like you can study whatever the heck you want.
Yeah.
I was like social movements in Latin America and New York City. I'm always embarrassed when I say that. I mean, it's a cool thing to study, but it's sort of like lengthy and obtuse.
Yeah, you could acronym.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So after college, I went and made a documentary with my brothers called What Are We Doing Here? Where we traveled from Cairo to Cape Town across Africa looking at food aid and sort of the often negative impact of sort of humanitarian aid. And came back to Brooklyn to edit it and started working again in restaurants. And my first job was at Bouchon in New York, in Manhattan. And so I was kind of like editing, making movies while learning to cook and cooking at these different restaurants. So I sort of, for a number of years, was straddling the two.
Yeah.
And that included my time at Applewood, which was awesome. I left other restaurants to go work there because every week they bring in a whole cow and goat, sheep, and butcher it. So I got to learn how to do that, which was really a really fantastic experience.
Yeah, but you added to your international repertoire in cooking at the Fat Duck, Hessen Blumenthal's restaurants, St. John or St. John, Fergus Henderson's restaurant. At Mugaritz with Andoni Adruiz. And how did you get into those establishments?
Well, the Fat Duck was a stage, and so you can just go there. I mean, you have to apply, and I have British dual citizenship, so working is a non-issue in Europe, which is really helpful. And also after working at a Thomas Keller restaurant, it opens up doors, so people give you a degree of respect that maybe because they've heard of the restaurant, you know, so it's like, oh, he worked there, so it's fine, you know, he can come and try it out here. And that was really a break from editing that What Are We Doing Here, that Africa documentary. It was like we had 350 hours of this film, cutting it down to 80 minutes, and it was just like the most challenging thing that I'd ever done. And so it was like, all right, I got to stop. So we stopped working for a year on the project, and I went to Europe and did that, and then came back and finished that movie.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought a professional in to help you with all the video and editing in Mira Fine, who actually has a background in video more so than Daniel.
No,
just none. Graphic design and marketing. And
Yeah.
So why did you guys take on this venture? I mean, did you have a specific food interest before? Or
no, I just love junk food. Really, I love junk food, and like unabashedly. And he was the first person who made me feel really badly about it.
Yeah, oh, that's nice.
I was judgmental.
Yeah, what specific junk food?
I had this dish which was Campbell's minestrone soup with Uncle Ben's white rice. Kraft Parmesan cheese.
Wait, did you just say I have this dish? Like this was a recipe of yours you gave out to friends?
It's a recipe that I do when he goes out of town.
Yeah.
I go out and get that and like a Coke and a romantic comedy, and it's the best weekends of my life.
Yeah.
But like Kraft Parmesan cheese, I would go through, you know, a container every 2 weeks. You know, I was seriously devoted to that.
Yeah. I mean, I spent most of my college career also cooking as such, even though I was in restaurants of higher acclaim than my own. It's not a bad thing. At least you're combining can with cheese and rice. So it feels like more of a recipe. But then you two met, and there was this...
It's amazing connection.
Yeah.
He actually said that he normally only dates, like, activists or people who, you know, are not big junk food eaters. So
yeah.
I feel kind of good about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at where you are now, too. He's taken you so far away from the junk food that you're traveling around the nation looking for good food. That's jumping ahead a little to what the Perennial Plate is, but we might as well. That's why you guys are here. You are actually on tour right now.
Yeah, we're filming in New York City this week.
Yeah.
And we're doing events around the country to showcase some of the stories from the road. So we did a dinner on Sunday night at Prune, which was fantastic. It was really awesome to work with Gabrielle Hamilton, who's just a badass.
Yeah.
I had to swear in some way because I know we're allowed to swear.
Yeah, not FCC regular to drop them. You can even make up new curse words if you like. But Gabrielle Hamilton, Prune in East Village, was there a specific theme to the menu, or was it just to be able to work with her?
Yeah, there was a theme. I mean, I think working at that restaurant was very cool because what we try to convey in the videos that we make is sort of a human and vulnerable connection where we're not manufacturing anything. It's very honest and real to like what those people are. And I think that restaurant is very unique in that it's a representation of who Gabrielle is. It's not no one else's food. It's, you know, it's her food. And so we, thankfully she watched the videos and loved them. And so we collaborated on a menu to incorporate the ideas, her aesthetic with the aesthetic of the films, as well as my own need to use ingredients that were very specifically from the New York area.
Yeah. So what was on the menu?
Excuse me. We had, let's see, the main course was deep fried porgy, with heirloom tomatoes and oregano. That was coming from a video we did where we had deep fried catfish, and instead of catfish, we used porgy. We had pig, grilled pig's heart with green tomatoes and cucumbers and pumpkin seed oil. We had
this amazing dish from that was inspired by our episode in New Orleans on a Vietnamese shrimp fisherman boat, and it was oysters, or one oyster, and then
ceviche, and then a packet, like a tinfoil packet, with shrimp in it, you know, full on shrimp that we just threw on the burner, and so we just put it on the table with, you know, whole shrimp, so people could open it up and take it apart and get the smell coming off, you know, and of the shrimp cooked in its own juices.
I love that you use your episodes as inspiration for the menu too. I mean, that recall really speaks a lot, I think, of the influence that the subjects and sites you've seen, you know, made on you.
And otherwise it would have been, I'm sure the food would have been delicious, but it adds another element when you can, like, you know, draw from other sensory, you know, from the videos that people have seen, because a lot of people who are coming have seen many of the films.
Yeah.
Or if they haven't, they were bringing someone who had, and so people could talk about the relationship. And then I talked and got to express that as well.
Yeah. So the beginnings of these films actually weren't part of a national tour. You spent a year in Minnesota making weekly videos. How stifling was it being in one place for so long?
That was great, and I think it was really like a blessing. I think if someone had been making weekly videos about sustainable food in California, people have been like, whatever.
You know,
of course, it's always sustainable. I mean, it's all, everything's grown there. But because we're in Minnesota and it's a challenge, it added. And because people don't know much, they're like, this is Minnesota. Middle of the
wild
country.
Rice, right?
Yeah. You know, corn.
Yeah.
And we didn't know much, you know, so now it makes us look at Minneapolis differently. Like, it's this wide array of all these possibilities in food that we didn't realize.
So what were you doing at the time in Minnesota? You were both working as well as, you know, photographing, editing, making these videos?
I moved to Minnesota thinking of maybe opening a restaurant.
Yeah.
Decided against that. And was sort of doing, searching and thinking of, like, how to incorporate the things that I wanted to do, which is sort of to make an influence, like be an activist for food, or, you know, change things, continue in my, like, filmmaking development as well as cook.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, let's create this thing, you know? And it was going to be a pilot for a TV show. And for anyone who's, like, tried to pitch a pilot or made a documentary or done anything like that, the time between when you create it and ever seeing it come into fruition can be years. You know, it's a really frustrating experience. And even when you do, especially with documentary films, it may never reach the kind of audience that you hope it would. So with the internet, you know, it's out the next day, the next week. It's very immediate, and there's the opportunity for, you know, all types of folks just to watch it for free. So instead of doing the pilot, we did that. You know, I don't know why I decided that a year would be a good amount of time to do it for, and that I should do it every week was sort of insane. But, you know, once we started and had people support, then there was no stopping it.
Yeah. So the transition from Minnesota to take it on the road, what was the impetus for that?
Because we finished the year.
Yeah.
And we were like, okay.
We didn't want to stop, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
We were having a lot of fun, and people were watching it and interested in it. And so it was like, you know, what's the next step? We'd done, you know, you could tell infinite stories about individuals doing great things in Minnesota.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many farms, so many people who are worth spending time with. But to continue the growth and progression of it, I think we needed to develop it and do something a little different.
Yeah. So what was show one of season two?
It was us leaving.
Yeah.
It showed us leaving, and then it showed us going to Iowa to this amazing farm called Radiance Dairy, where this guy has, you know, tons of cows and lets them live out their lives and finds a way to let them retire so that they're not killed after they're done, you know, creating market quality amounts of milk.
And it's sort of funny because we had made these videos in Minnesota, and we'd go to a farm and then come back and cook in our kitchen, And then we were on the road, and it was like, oh shit, we don't have a kitchen. So there's this sort of funny scene in the car where we're making a, I made a violet lassi
with
yogurt from the farm. And we, of course, you know, sound is always an issue, so we had to turn off the air conditioning. It's like 100 degrees outside, and we're like, you know, sweating in there making this yogurt drink. It was really delicious, but it was sort of, and you know, like plugging my hand blender into the radio.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I also love in episode one, right when you get started, you're packing the car and trying to figure out what to take, and you are pseudo adamant about taking a pasta maker. Yeah. Just the things that you think you're going to need on the road.
Right.
Yeah.
We actually, when we came back, we did a loop of the West Coast and back to Minnesota for, we did an event in Minnesota and we tried to take some time off. And part of that was also dropping off all the stuff that we never touched, which included a big box of books that I had brought. Our bikes.
Mira's shaking her head.
Because
right
when
now.
He packed it, I was like, really? You're going to read all those humongous, like, hardcover books?
Yeah.
When are you going to read them?
Cookbooks like, are not the most transportable things, which I'm assuming they were.
There was a mixture, but yeah, some of them were cookbooks.
Yeah.
They were all cookbooks.
Yeah.
They were all cookbooks. And,
and our bikes, which we didn't, we were hoping we'd get to use, and we didn't really.
So, yeah, we thought we would have time for stuff. And we don't, because it's wonderful. We're having, like, the best time ever, and it's incredible to meet all these people, but it's very challenging to put out an episode, to travel, to have an event, to film, and to organize the next leg of the trip all in a week.
Yeah. Speaking of organization, you were talking about the internet and putting it on there so more people can see. Two-part. How do you plot out your route, and how has Twitter and Facebook helped you guys find subjects and places to hold events?
Initially, we plotted out the route by deciding when the weather would be the best. But we didn't account for hurricanes or, like, flooding.
Or earthquakes, for that matter, here in Brooklyn. Yeah.
So, the hurricane on the East Coast kind of messed us up a little bit schedule-wise. But so we really had to just sit down and see by weeks, like, where we thought we would be for each week. And then when we know where we're going to be, then we start looking for stories, or we get, you know, we're on the Huffington Post, so we asked for a call for stories and got hundreds and hundreds of people sending stories to us. And then when we're going to be there, maybe like a 2 or 3 weeks ahead of time, we'll start looking at that location and finding something.
We had been planning further out, but we found a lot of stuff falling through, so we decided to do it more immediate. So, but getting story ideas in social media has been pretty effective, in a lot of ways. First off, that database that we developed on our website is incredibly useful. And then when things fall through, that's when we reach out for the Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
And be like, we're in Montana. This guy canceled on us. Like, who knows a grass-fed beef, you know, we did do that in Montana on Facebook, and we ended up at this most beautiful place because we were looking to do it in a beautiful place because there's a lot about grass-fed beef, but Montana's, you know, the most striking and gorgeous place in the world, and so we wanted to combine those two together.
Yeah.
We were in Seattle, and we had a gooey duck, and we need to find a place to cook it. But we were staying with my family who keeps kosher, so we couldn't do it there.
Yeah.
And then my friend hates shellfish, and I didn't want to, like, make her apartment smell. So we just went on Facebook and said, who has a house and a kitchen and will let us come over? And someone did.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We're actually going to take a quick break and come back, actually, to the gooey duck. Your travels there, digging with Hank Shaw and at the restaurant Herb Farm. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here with the rhyming couple, Daniel Klein and Mira Fine of The Perennial Plate.
That's alliteration in there, too, so rhyming and then alliteration.
Yeah, yeah. I was much better at math than English, so all those things befall me. We were just talking about gooey duck, and I was also excited that you pronounced it prior to me, because I usually say geoduck at first, just phonetically seeing it spelled out. But what was so cool, that episode, which was in and around Seattle, am I mm-hmm. correct? Had a whole bunch of different parts to it. The first was Hank Shaw, who, if you don't people know, and we're also trying to get him on the show eventually, is an amazing forager. And it's even that much more so. And you went digging for sea beans with him. Mm-hmm. And then later went to, well, is it considered hunting or finding gooey duck?
Digging.
Digging, yeah.
That's the real activity. Yeah. Well, first you got to find it, and then you got to dig for it.
Yeah, well, you had to dig by hand too eventually.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Someone broke
the shovel. No, but okay, so in the video of the gooey duck,
yeah.
That was actually the second hole we had dug. The first one, the tide had come in, and we hadn't.
Yeah.
It was way, way down, and it was a huge one. So they were really excited about it, but we never got to it.
Yeah, and you were doing that with Langdon Cook?
With Langdon Cook, who's also a forager and writer.
Yeah, and then eventually hooking up with Herb Farm, a wonderful Five Diamond restaurant, I think, out in Seattle.
Yeah.
With their chef, Chris Weber.
Right, and we made salt with him. But even cooler than that was the owner of Herb Farm gave us a taste of a wine from 1795, a Madeira. That was cool.
Yeah.
For Mira's birthday.
Yeah, that's not a bad little gift.
It was a really
yeah.
cool.
But what I love, though, is talk about amalgamating, you know, your loves. You amalgamated your episode into a final recipe, which you cooked at somebody's home who you had never met, that you had met through social media, incorporating all the things of that day, from sea beans to gooey duck.
Well, it wasn't. This is the joy of editing.
Yeah,
that was filmed over a month period.
Yeah,
One of them with Hank Shaw is in the Bay Area in Bodega Bay.
Gotcha.
And then the other two were up in Seattle.
Yeah,
and we, you know, we combined the episodes together because, well, they had similarities, and it would have been difficult for. We didn't want to give people one sea foraging. Followed by another, sea foraging, followed by another. So we kind of
yeah
put them together.
But
into
I mean,
one piece.
I think that's great in the sense that you show all these common threads and you show all these analogous, you know, people and features and figures and, you know, modes and methods happening around the nation, that nothing seems so you know, foreign in a sense.
Right. Well, thanks.
Yeah. But I mean, from foraging up in the Pacific Northwest to. You've already mentioned fishing down in New Orleans with a Vietnamese man looking for shrimp.
Yeah, we have it awesome because we don't have to do what anyone wants except for what we want. You know, the show is completely independent. So, and there isn't even a formula that we have to follow. You know, if you have a show on television, there's a set. You know, it has to follow these breaks and this theme. Ours can be 3 minutes long. It can be 15 minutes long. It can, you know, be a montage, or it can be just an interview. We can really do
yeah.
what we want. And so it gives a chance for us to show the characters how they really are, as opposed to trying to manipulate them into the story that we want it to fit.
Or as opposed to making it just like local or sustainable. You know, we can also go catfish noodling
yeah.
and show like what people do because that's what they've learned growing up, and it's, you know, adventurous.
Yeah, there's the
you
know? the adventurous cat.
Yeah. Can we talk about catfish noodling? I don't know if I saw that episode because I think, you know, I went through as many episodes as possible in the last couple of days.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
really good. You should see that one.
Yeah. What goes on? Where is it?
So it's in... It's backwoods Mississippi, in like right outside a really tiny town called Liberty.
Oh, is that the Lord one?
No, that's
New Orleans.
Okay.
But this one, so catfish noodlers are really secretive about where they noodle, if you will. So,
I would be too if I was noodling about. Yeah.
So we had to go on a fishing forum, Mississippi fishing forum, and just keep on putting out messages saying, will someone take us out? And finally, this woman who lost her leg to a snake bite called us and was like, yep, we'll take you. And so we went in the backwoods, Mississippi, and they took us out.
We showed up at these people's house, and they were really wonderful people, but it was really in the middle of nowhere, yeah. And they had a lot of guns, and they had Confederate flags, and a huge table just filled with, that was cement, and then Bud Light tops covered it, you know?
Yeah.
Like thousands of bottles.
Which they proudly brought us over to show us.
It was cool.
Yeah. I mean, I think I did that in college as well.
Yeah. But they weren't in college.
No.
But they were really, we still communicate with a lot of the people that on the road. And Mira gets text messages every few days from them saying, like, love the episode or whatever.
Not usually. It's like, hey, girl. It's really bad.
Yeah.
Well.
That's awesome. Frog hunting in Arkansas. Feral pigs in Texas, diving for sea urchins, gleaning in Healdsburg, California. I mean, so many awesome things that you've got to experience because of this. But have you found any to be harder than you thought? Or were there things that you walked into, saying, I know how to dive for sea urchin, and it was completely opposite of what you assumed?
Well, as far as the sea urchin, I mean, I didn't know how to dive for sea urchin, but I had a perspective about sea urchin and its taste, and that I found to be interesting and worth trying, but not something that I loved.
Mm-hmm.
But eating it out of the shell was unbelievable. It was like a real perspective changing experience on that and how incredibly delicious it can be. But that wasn't hard. That was just great, you know.
I think the feral pig hunt was really hard, like draining and emotionally hard, and I think it was the only time where I called my mom and I was like, I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah. You
know,
and this was in Texas, and it's not necessarily for sport or a game. Like they are a menace down there, aren't
right.
they?
Right, they're killed, you know, in helicopters with machine guns. You know, they're trying to wipe out the species.
And how big are these boar?
Well, they can be hundreds of pounds. The one that we cooked was probably 80 pounds, something like that, 70 pounds. It was a decent size. But because it was for the show and because we wanted to, you know, respect the animal, we tried to use everything. Usually you skin wild boar because there's so much hair. And if you don't skin it, then you boil it, you know, to blanch the hair off of it. But the person who we were doing this with, who's also become a friend of ours, Niles, he thought he had this, he basically couldn't find the stove to blanch it.
Yeah.
So we had to burn off the hair, and it's like the worst job in the world.
And the smell of burning hair.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
And it stays on you for a long time. For days. You have that kind of like burnt pig hair smell.
Were there any other wonderful olfactory moments in the show itself?
There was a moment of silence there.
Well, I thought I smelled burning hair for a second.
Yeah.
I had to check.
I don't think so. Were there?
Mm.
You know, another surprise taste was how delicious that the gooey duck is, actually. It's a really, it's a delicacy in it, but it's so strange looking.
Yeah. Well, it's if people walk around Chinatown, it's that thing that, the foot, right, that comes out of it, but it looks like a giant wiener.
Yeah.
Coming out of a large, oversized clamshell.
It was so windy that day, there would have been a lot more jokes heard if the microphone wasn't, like, totally blown out.
Plus, like, I was far, you know, I was hiding behind the other film crew, so I could only get, like, really inappropriate shots of it where it just...
Yeah,
I put it up on Facebook, and my sister wrote and was like, "Really, Mira?" And I was like, "Jenny, you should have seen the other one." And then I sent her the other picture, and she was like, "Okay."
Yeah,
it
was tough.
Yeah, you have recipes for some of these things on your website as well.
Yeah,
and people can recreate those experiences, but they can also participate in offering you an idea or a place to have an event or have a meal. You're here in New York right now, having taped through. Where are you going to next? And are you looking for ideas? Are you looking for, you know, specific things?
We are still looking for ideas. We're headed down to Florida for the winter. We have lots of ideas along the way, but there's still lots of gaps all from New York down to Florida. And we are looking for ideas. We are not looking people are like, oh, are always telling us about a great CSA or a great urban garden. And what we look for is really about the people behind the story. So we love for folks to give ideas, but like, there's got to be a story or something a little different besides just like growing great organic vegetables, which is totally awesome. And it's amazing that all those stories are out there. But there needs to be something that can draw people in and make them want to watch.
Can I bring up one which I didn't think was as much food related, but was absolutely charming? And I see why you want to have a whole documentary about the Stone Twins.
Sure.
That's one of my favorite episodes. You're in Utah, and what are these ruins that they kind of live in and amongst?
The Anasazi ruins, down in this valley in Utah, they basically you walk out their front door and you can pick up shards of pottery. It's incredible. And
it's all over their farm.
Yeah, and it's in their, they're still farming and picking them out. It's not like they're like plowing through like a, you know, burial ground. In fact, they're very lucky that they're not on a burial ground. Otherwise, then they would have to move their farm. But one of the guys is...
You can't tell.
What?
Were you going to say why they're down there?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have to tell you off air.
There are secrets.
There are secrets.
Yeah. There's like huge secrets.
Yeah. There. Watch the episode. It seems very secretive to
really?
Me. Yeah. Okay. Seems like very Area 51-esque.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we got taken out at night with night vision goggles, and one of the guys was like, within your lifetime it'll come out that Area 51 is the reason for this technology.
Yeah.
Also, they love Yanni.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I remember that's they were talking about their Yanni collection.
They talked about it the whole time, and at night they would have us watch Yanni concerts.
It was great. They were late in the season, so that's why there wasn't a lot of food growing yet.
Yeah.
But it was really funny because they were like these guys who had, 10 years worth of food in their cave, yet they were like, had never cooked. So they didn't know how to cook for themselves. So we went and their kitchen was a mess. So they didn't want me to cook in there. So we kind of like, we had some sandwiches that we had bought earlier in the day. And like the first night we ended up sitting around eating these sandwiches.
Yeah.
And they had like all this freeze dried food too. And they wanted to, we're like, why do you guys have all that food? You know?
Yeah. But you ended up having elk steaks or something.
Right. We did have elk steaks.
And I saw you spicing up the elk steaks because I don't want to know what their flavor profiles were.
Well, no, I was using
their pantry.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I just put salt and pepper.
Yeah.
and the steak was good, but it was funny. It was a great, there's been several moments on the trip where we're just like, wow, we're, in it. And this is like really a unique, awesome experience to be meeting folks that we would just never in our day-to-day life have that sort of interaction with.
Yeah.
Like those are the types of stories we're looking for,
Exactly. Yeah.
Really. Like
not crazy, not people who are like necessarily conspiracy theorists, but folks who have,
A really interesting story regarding food. And another thing I just want to point out is that people also send us story ideas that are like restaurants, which we're not going to want to do an episode on a restaurant. It's just is not as like visually appealing usually.
We'll cook at the restaurants. Yeah. We'll do events at restaurants, which has been really fun to do.
But not an episode around the restaurant usually.
Yeah. So if anyone out there has these wonderful humanistic stories around food, please contact the Perennial Plate. And the website is perennialplate.com.
The Perennial Plate.
The Perennial Plate.com.
I think Perennial Plate links there.
Yeah.
Humanistic things, because we, drawing, I feel like the way to help us make better decisions when we end up at the grocery store is like to be having that relationship with our farmers or producers.
Yeah.
And it's hard. Not everyone can like take the time to go out to the farm or whatever, but by trying to capture like the moments of humanity and vulnerability in characters, then maybe you have more of a relationship.
Yeah. So watch your Perennial Plate so you can meet these people and hopefully one day visit the Stone Twins in Utah.
They give tours.
Yeah.
They do give tours.
Daniel Mir, thank you so much for being on. I can't wait to see where you go next. Maybe international next year?
Could be.
Yeah.
Excellent. Never know.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkill. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Go.
The following is a message from the Climate Reality Project. Join us on September 14th to the 15th for 24 Hours of Reality, a presentation delivered in locations around the world, sponsored by former U.S. Vice President Al Gore. View the live stream at climaterealityproject.org. Go to our website, tell your friends, join our watch party, and help others learn about what can change in a day. Again, that's climaterealityproject.org. This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today.